grand honor of having a stretch of Interstate 40 near his Gordon Road boyhood home named after him. Dean Smith was there, his plaid sports jacket contrasting with Jordan's sleekly cut tan suit with a dapper silk pocket hanky. The tears streamed down his face in the Indian summer heat at the ribbon-cutting ceremony. Juanita gently wiped them away after he returned to his seat. But perhaps the most tender moment had come before the ceremony started, when James Jordan, dressed in his own dapper light blue suit and sporting a bee-like Mike button on his left lapel, stepped onto the platform to shake his son's hand. Still seated, Jordan looked up at his father with a broad, beatific grin and patted his shoulder. That same week, Jordan had been named to the 1992 U.S. Olympic basketball team. The announcement came after a negotiation in which Jordan was adamant that he would not play on the team if the roster included Isaiah Thomas. After his intense and sometimes unpleasant experience on the 1984 Olympic team, Jordan had been reluctant to get involved in what would come to be called the Dream Team. Jack McCallum of Sports Illustrated reported that the selection committee decided not to invite Thomas because of questions about how he might affect the team's chemistry. The story suggested that neither Chuck Daly nor Detroit GM Jack McCloskey, who was on the selection committee, had put up much of a case for including Thomas. More than anything, the story damaged the Pistons' hopes of recovering from their disastrous loss to Chicago in the playoffs. Their chemistry had taken a severe hit. Meanwhile, Esquinas had begun phoning Jordan to inquire about payment for their wager. Esquinas would reveal 3 years later that Jordan replied with a laugh, "Rich, I just might as well shoot you as to give you a check for $1.2 million. The comment left Esquinas more than a bit fearful and prompted him to contemplate the great value Jordan held for various interested parties. "I feared that I'd be perceived as a threat to Jordan and the things that come with those fears," he said. "I played it off," Esquinas would later reveal. But he was definitely drawing the line that he wasn't going to pay the full amount. What he was saying was, "I'm not paying the full amount," and right there I knew I had trouble collecting. The Book of Revelations. Although the golf losses remained out of public light, Sam Smith's book, The Jordan Rules, would land as another bombshell in his life that fall and immediately set the entire organization on edge. It was an intensely negative portrait of Jordan, but also of Frumpy Krause and his substantial hubris. Phil Jackson would later note that the book had accomplished something truly rare. It gave Jordan and Krause something they agreed on. "Sam Smith made some money on that book," the GM would say several years later. "I hope he chokes on every dollar." The book, however, was truly revelatory about the hard edges of Jordan's competitiveness. Always hugely sensitive, he was angered and deeply hurt by the depiction. The public, meanwhile, soaked it up, delighted by this figure with a diamond-hard will who drove everyone around him to an odd amalgam of misery and greatness. Rather than damage Jordan's image, it spurred yet more worship. The impact of the Jordan Rules contributed to Jordan's sense of being besieged and to the fabric of what Jackson called the pack. "The Jordan Rules was very divisive to the team," the coach recalled. Horace Grant served as one of the sources which angered Jordan. "I knew people were going to start taking shots at me," Jordan told Mark Vansell. "You get to a point where people are going to get tired of seeing you on a pedestal, all clean and polished. They say, let's see if there's any dirt around this person. But I never expected it to come from inside. Sam tried to make it seem like he was a friend of the family for 8 months. But the family talked about all this hatred they have for me. I mean, if they had so much hatred for me, how could they play with me? I don't know how we won if there was so much hatred among all of us. It looked like we all got along so well." The same resentment surfaced just weeks later when Jordan decided not to join the team in the traditional Rose Garden ceremony with President George Bush. Instead, he headed off on a golf trip with a group of pals that included childhood friend David Bridgers. The White House fuss spurred yet more discord between Grant and Jordan. "I think it was a situation where Horace felt demeaned, felt that he was made light of, and he wanted to be a person of importance," Phil Jackson observed. "There were some things about Horace that bothered Michael. Basically, Horace says whatever comes into his mind in front of the press. One of the situations that was exacerbating to Michael came after our first championship, when Horace and his wife and Michael and his wife went to New York. They went to dinner and to see a play. While they were out, Michael basically told Horace that he wasn't going to see President Bush. Michael said, 'It's not obligatory, it's on my time, and I have other things to do.' Horace at the time had no problem with it. He knew about this in a private situation and said nothing. Yet when the press came into the picture later, after the story became public, and asked Horace if it bothered him, he made a big issue of it. Basically, the press had put the words in his mouth, and he felt it was a good time to make this kind of statement. "No way am I going," Jordan told reporters when asked about the traditional visit. "No one asked me if the date was convenient. It's okay if the other guys go, but the White House is just like any other house. It's just cleaner." Just days before the White House event, Jordan had made something of an awkward appearance on Saturday Night Live, along with Jesse Jackson and the rap group Public Enemy. Jordan didn't want to do it, but Sonny Vaccaro talked him into it, and even went to New York to sit in NBC's green room with him. Phil Knight had recently fired Vaccaro from Nike, but he moved on to successes with other athletic shoe companies. "When Phil let me go, Michael called me. One of the first calls I got," Vaccaro recalled. "He said, 'What can I do? You want me to call Phil?' And I said, 'No, it's done.'" Like Rob Strasser and others who had moved on from Nike, Vaccaro had pushed for Jordan to demand his own brand in the wake of the overwhelming success of the Air Jordan shoe. "I was so much involved in making sure that Michael asked for that," Vaccaro said. "I mean, that was my last will and testament to Michael. I told him, 'You've got to get a piece of this company.' I mean, that's what it was." One of Vaccaro's last chores for Nike and Jordan was cleaning up the final details of the mess with the Flight 23 stores and James Jordan. "Michael was frustrated with not being able to just close it down," Vaccaro recalled. "It got to the point where he stood up and said that James had to close it down. If money could stop it, it had to be stopped." That same busy month, NBC aired a comedy salute to Michael Jordan, a comic relief primetime special to raise funds for homeless children. Tickets to the event, which was taped at the Chicago Theater in July, ran as much as $400, and thousands filled the streets outside, hoping to catch a glimpse of Jordan. He and Juanita sat in a box in the audience, obviously embarrassed as an array of stars worked their way through skits about him. MC Billy Crystal kicked off the event by poking fun at the vast number of products endorsed by Jordan. "I have Michael Jordan everything," he said. "I even have Michael Jordan contact lenses. They make everybody else look shorter and slower." To repay NBC for all its effort in producing the fundraiser, Vaccaro finally got Jordan to agree to do Saturday Night Live. "That was the biggest thing in the world to do," Vaccaro said, and he was a little bit nervous about doing it. He almost didn't do it. Sports Illustrated's Jack McCallum was there in the green room too, observing a Jordan both entertained by the SNL cast and put upon for autographs. The producers had wanted to do a skit about an effort by Jordan to keep Isaiah Thomas off the Olympic team, but he refused. His opening segment in hosting SNL was roundly flat and unfunny, and Jordan certainly rued the decision afterward. It was in the wake of these events that Jordan's first real trouble surfaced. In December, police surveillance of a Charlotte man, a convicted cocaine dealer named James Slim Buhler, turned up a $57,000 check that Jordan had written to him. Buhler was later charged with money laundering and tax evasion. Both Buhler and Jordan told authorities that the money was a loan, but Jordan was soon caught up in Buhler's troubles and would later be served with a subpoena to testify in the case against him. Then, in February 1992, a bail bondsman, Eddie Dow, was murdered during a robbery at his home. Thieves took $20,000 in cash from a safe on the premises, but left three checks worth $108,000 written by Jordan. The lawyer handling Dow's estate confirmed that the checks were for gambling debts owed by Jordan to a North Carolina contractor named Dean Chapman and two other men. Press reports revealed that Jordan often hosted small gatherings for golfing and gambling at his Hilton Head Island residence, where Jordan had lost the money. Dow had been to at least three such gatherings, according to his attorney. Jordan was also known to host Mike's Time, a gathering for golf and high-stakes poker before training camp each season. The reports prompted NBA Commissioner David Stern to issue a reprimand to Jordan. The league soon launched the first of two investigations into Jordan's activities, although they were limited in scope. Neither Jerry Krause nor Sonny Vaccaro was approached about an interview. Krause said in 2012 that the Bulls were as surprised as anyone else when Jordan's issues came to light, but they never made any attempt to learn more about his off-court activities. That was surprising considering that Krause worked in the Los Angeles Lakers front office in the late 1970s. The Lakers, according to former GM Pete Newell, employed off-duty LAPD vice officers to keep track of players' activities. Phil Jackson would later accuse Krause, aka the Sleuth, of spying on the off-court activities of Bulls players, which Krause also denied. "I have complete confidence in him as a person," Krause said of Jordan. Nike took a similar approach. In his private life, he should be able to do what every other person can do. He's not the president or the pope, replied Dusty Kidd, a Nike spokesman, when queried by reporters. He had problems, Sonny Vaccaro recalled in 2012. He's the only guy that could have survived the gambling stuff. You know that, don't you? 20 years later, Krauss offered his take on the matter, too. I didn't know that there were gambling issues, he said. I knew he played cards on the airplane. You'd hear the guys yelling at one another. I didn't know what the stakes were. Later on, I found out that they were very high. But all the great old-timers in the NBA used to gamble. I was used to that. I was used to guys playing cards. That's the way of the NBA. As for Michael, it was just his way of living. So what? He had the money. He was never non-professional. That sucker showed up every night, and he was ready to play. I saw him do tons of charitable things, good deeds, and tons of asinine things, too. He is who he is. Dominion. One by one, the icons who had stood so long in front of Jordan fell by the wayside. Isaiah Thomas and his Pistons crumbled, then melted away like the Wicked Witch of the West. For Larry Bird, it was the indignity of age, the back troubles, the ball short at the rim, the dismissals in the early rounds of the playoffs. But the biggest icon fell on November 7, 1991, while Jordan was at practice. Lon Rosen, Magic Johnson's agent, phoned Bulls PR man Tim Hallam that morning. Rosen delivered to Jordan the same bad news that a small circle of the NBA elite had gotten. Magic Johnson would announce his retirement immediately that afternoon in Los Angeles because he had recently tested positive for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Stunned, Jordan gathered himself, then asked about his childhood hero, "Is he gonna die?" It was the question on the minds of millions as that strange and curious NBA season opened. And many high-profile players quietly went on their own to get tested, because so many of them had partied in the same LA playground where Johnson had explored excess. Jordan himself was not free of these rumors, including one in which he was said to have wagered large sums with teammates over which Hollywood starlets he would bed during the team's West Coast road swings. He was likewise rumored to have collected on at least one such bet, although how he supposedly confirmed his success was left unclear. As for basketball, the Bulls opened the season 1-2, and it looked as though they might be in for another transition, marked by more internal struggles and frustration. No team had repeated as NBA champions since the days of Boston's Bill Russell dynasty until Pat Riley drove his Lakers to a second straight title in 1988. But the pressure of that push had destroyed his relationships with his players. Riley was soon gone, and Magic Johnson thoroughly depleted. Jackson was aware of the risks of pushing such an agenda. A host of side issues were already driving his desire to have his players explore meditation and the Zen mentality. For whatever reason, they soon showed extraordinary focus. The one great thing about this group of guys, Jackson would say looking back, was that they never let the external stuff bother the team's play on the floor. Krauss set the roster with a November trade, sending disgruntled Dennis Hobson to Sacramento for reserve guard Bobby Hansen. After those two early losses, they quickly gained clarity and rode on the wings of a new emerging force, Scottie Pippen. In 1992, Jordan was far and away the best player in the league, Jim Stack observed, but Scottie had caught up to the point that their games were 1 and 1A. In looking back on the development 4 years later, Tex Winter pointed out that Pippen, like Magic Johnson, had grown into that special type of player who made his teammates much better, I think more so than Michael. It's my personal opinion that there are times, not always certainly, but there are times when Michael detracts from his teammates. You're not going to find that much in Pippen. He's totally unselfish. Michael should be selfish because he's such a great scorer. Michael is uninhibited, and Michael is going to look to score most of the time when he's in a position where he thinks he can, whereas Scottie on many occasions will pass up that opportunity just to get his teammates involved. Jordan obviously was basketball's great force, but it was Pippen who learned to channel that force in ways that few other players could. As he had displayed in the championship series, Pippen had developed into a defensive presence that, in turn, made the Bulls a great defensive team. There would be much focus on the triangle offense as the team got better and better at executing it that season, but their defense gave opponents reason for pause. Their defense is so terrific already, plainspoken Utah coach Jerry Sloan said after studying the Bulls, that when they decide to step it up a notch, they can annihilate you. If you panic in that situation, you're in trouble, and most teams panic. Jackson himself would come to call it cracking the case, that moment in the game when his team would rise to another level. Feeding their opponents' panic, they raced out to a 37-5 record, including a 14-game winning streak in November and December, the longest in the franchise's history. In January, they ripped off another 13 straight, then slipped late in the month and into February, going only 11-8. "We had a phenomenal start to the season," recalled Chip Schaefer, who had been hired as the Bulls' new trainer. "We had a 37-5 record, but then we headed west and lost 4 of 6 games before the All-Star break. Michael got ejected in Utah when he headbumped Tommy Wood, the official. We were in a triple overtime game, and Wood called a foul on Michael in the third overtime. It was an accidental headbutt. Michael was vehement in his argument, and they bumped heads. Wood ejected him from the game, and we wound up losing with Jeff Malone's free throws." Jordan also fouled out of a game that season. He would not foul out of another game for the rest of his years with the Bulls, despite being an aggressor in Jackson's pressure defense. In 930 regular season games in Chicago, he would foul out just 10 times. He would foul out just 3 times in another 179 playoff games with the Bulls. Since the days of Wilt Chamberlain, the NBA had been a league that did not like to lose its stars to disqualification. "It was a galling loss," Bulls VP Steve Schoenwald remembered of Jordan's ejection in Utah. "Prior to the call, the game was one of the greatest ever. If not for that call, it likely would have been the NBA's first quadruple overtime game ever." "Then Michael had to sit out the next game, which was the game in Phoenix," Chip Schaefer recalled. "So he just flew on to the All-Star game in Orlando." Pippen and Jackson joined him there a day later. Even though he had retired in November, Magic Johnson was allowed to return for the All-Star game, where he owned the weekend and was named MVP. That spring, in the wake of the revelations about his golf and gambling binges, Jordan addressed the strange arc of his life in an interview with the Tribune's Melissa Isaacson. "It's just one of those things that happened," he said of his sudden fame. "And it shocked everybody. It's a hell of a burden, and it's just one of those things that I stumbled into. Then you see people counting on you so much that you start to try to constantly maintain it, and that's when the pressure starts to mount. Suddenly, everything you do, you have to stop and think, how is this going to be perceived?" He had been contrite at first. The public still did not yet know about Richard Esquinas. Jordan's connections with a cast of unsavory characters captured in the police reports and hearing transcripts had been quite enough. "At some point in my life, I probably would have to face it," he told Isaacson. "Very few people go through their lifetimes without scars. And I went through a 6 or 7 year period without them. Now I have a couple of scars, and I've got to mend them and keep moving on. The scars won't go away, but you know you're going to be a better person because of them." That might have been true if he had found some other outlet. His was a cycle of high-level competition, interspersed with golf, marathon poker games, and hanging out with his entourage. Also in there, he managed to fit in time with his family. "I tell my wife that I have a split personality," he said. "I lead two lives. Because in some ways, I'm projected to be a 38-39-year-old mature person who has experienced life to the fullest, and now he's more or less settled down and focused on very conservative things. But the other side of me is a 29-year-old who never really got the chance to experience his success with friends and maybe do some of the crazy things that 27-, 28-, 29-year-old people will do. And sometimes I have those urges to do those things, but it can only be done in the privacy of the very small group of people who really know you as that 29-year-old person." Isaacson asked if Jordan could just live as his alter ego. If he had, it would have likely been a short life, and Jordan acknowledged as much, just as he acknowledged that he felt ill at ease with a life beyond basketball, one in which he attempted to endorse political candidates or stand up as a role model. Jordan offered that he simply wasn't experienced enough to do those things well. "Everything seemed to snowball for the good," he said of his wealth and success off the court. "From a financial situation, it's worth it. But away from that, it has been a burden to a certain extent. It caused extra pressure, but at the same time, it earned the respect and admiration of a lot of people. Everyone likes to be respected and admired." In March, Richard Esquinas came to town to watch a Bulls victory over the Cavaliers in the stadium, a night when Jordan scored 44. The next night, Esquinas joined Michael and Juanita and the Chicago Bears' Richard Dent and his wife at the Jordan home for dinner. Jordan and Esquinas had been dickering over the golf debt for months. They had played intermittently over the season, and Jordan now owed just under $1 million. Eventually, the topic came up that night. He and Jordan retreated to the kitchen, where their tone turned heated. Jordan asked him to back off because the revelations of his other golf gambling had turned up the pressure on him. "You have to give me some space," Esquinas recalled, Jordan telling him. "You have to give me some time. I've got these other things to deal with." The Bulls closed out the schedule that spring with a blistering 19-2 run to finish 67-15, the franchise's best record. "We just coasted the rest of that season through one winning streak after another," Bulls trainer Chip Schaefer recalled. "The team was almost bored with success and could turn it on and off whenever they wanted to." With the structure of the triangle offense taking the ball out of his hands a bit more, Jordan's average had dipped to 30.1 points per game, but it was still enough to claim his sixth straight scoring crown and to win his third league MVP award. He and Pippen were named to the All-Defense First Team, and Pippen earned All-NBA Second Team honors. "We really had an outrageous year," Jackson said. "We won 67 games, and basically I felt like I had to pull back on the reins, or they would have tried to win 70 or 75. The postseason, however, brought a changed atmosphere, featuring a showdown with Pat Riley's New York Knicks, a team that had reprised Detroit's bad boy tactics. "We had injuries, and we had to face New York," Jackson recalled. "And teams were coming at us with a lot of vim and vigor. We lost 7 games in our championship run. It wasn't as easy this second time. There had been a challenge to our character as a team." In the first round of the playoffs, the Bulls faced the Miami Heat, a 1989 expansion team making its first postseason appearance. Chicago quickly claimed the first 2 games in the best-of-5 series, then headed to Miami for Game 3. "In Miami's first home playoff ever, it was clacker night," recalled Bulls broadcaster Tom Doerr. "What they said was, any time Michael gets the ball or shoots a free throw, go nuts with those clackers. Make all kinds of noise." Well, it worked in the first quarter. The Heat had a big lead, and in fact we were wondering, can the Bulls come back from this? And Michael stopped by the broadcast table and looked at Johnny Kerr and me and said, "Here we come." That's all he said. Boy, did he ever. He went absolutely berserk, scored 56 points, and the Bulls won, swept the series. The trial by fire came early that year in the second round of the Eastern playoffs. The Knicks muscled their way to a win in Game 1 in Chicago Stadium. B.J. Armstrong helped even the series at 1-1 by hitting big shots in the fourth quarter of Game 2. In Game 3 in New York, Jordan finally broke free of the cloying defense for his first dunks of the series. Powered by Xavier McDaniel, New York fought back to even it with a win in Game 4. In critical Game 5, Jordan took control by going to the basket. The Knicks kept fouling him, and he kept making the free throws, 15 in all, to finish with 37 points as the Bulls won 96-88. "Michael is Michael," Riley said afterward. "His game is to take it to the basket and challenge the defense. When you play against a guy like him, he tells you how much he wants to win by how hard he takes the ball to the basket." The Knicks managed to tie it again with a Game 6 win in New York, but the Bulls were primed for Game 7 in the stadium and walked to the win 110-81. They resumed their struggle in the conference finals against the Cavaliers, who managed to tie the series at 2 games apiece, but the Bulls had just enough to escape Cleveland 4-2. Jordan had carried his team to a second straight appearance in the league championship series, this time against the Portland Trail Blazers, the team that had bypassed him in the 1984 draft in favor of Kentucky big man Sam Bowie. Whether that decision qualified as one of the greatest sports blunders of all time had been debated in Oregon over the years every time Jordan burned Nike's hometown team for big points. Bowie, who had missed 2 years of his career at Kentucky with a slow-to-heal broken leg, would admit in 2012 that he lied to Portland team physicians during a 1984 physical to evaluate his leg. He said he told them he had no leg pain, when in fact he did. The irony is that it was Jordan, not Bowie, who first went out with serious injury, although Bowie would never reach his potential. In another irony, it was the Blazers who made it to the league championship series a year before a Jordan-led team reached it. Portland lost the 1990 title to Detroit. The Blazers of 1992 featured Clyde Drexler, Danny Ainge, Cliff Robinson, Terry Porter, and Buck Williams. Fans savored the opportunity to see a matchup with Drexler, who had an athleticism that matched Jordan's. Veteran observers sensed that Jordan, with his long memory, might try to make a statement as the series was set to open, but none of them could have imagined his outburst in Game 1 in Chicago Stadium. He scored an NBA Finals record 35 points in the first half, including a record 6 three-pointers, enough to bury the Blazers 122-89. He finished with 39 points after making 16 of 27 field goal attempts, including the 6 three-pointers, all highlighted by his trademark shrug. "The only way you can stop Michael," said Cliff Robinson, "is to take him off the court." "I was in a zone," said Jordan, who had focused on extra hours of practice shooting long range before Game 1. "My threes felt like free throws. I didn't know what I was doing, but they were going in." In Game 2, Drexler fouled out with about 4 minutes left, but the Blazers rallied with a 15-5 run to tie the game, then managed to win 115-104 on the strength of Danny Ainge's 9 points in overtime. The Blazers had their split with the series headed to Portland for 3 games. But the Bulls' defense and a solid team effort, Pippen and Grant scored 18 each to go with Jordan's 26 in Game 3, ended thoughts of an upset, although this time Jordan missed all 4 of his 3-point attempts. The Blazers struggled to stay close through most of Game 4, then moved in front with just over 3 minutes left and won it 93-88 on a final surge to even the series at 2-2. Jordan had made just 11 of 26 field goal attempts in Game 4, and it was clear that the critical Game 5 would be a test of endurance, with both teams having played more than 100 games on the season. Jordan came out aggressively, attacking the basket repeatedly, drawing fouls, and pushing the Bulls to an early lead. Chicago's coaches had surprised Portland by spreading the floor with their offense, which allowed Jordan open shots off of numerous backdoor cuts. He made 16 of 19 free throws to finish with 46 points, enough to give the Bulls a huge 119-106 win and a 3-2 lead. The Blazers had pulled close, but Jordan's scoring kept them at bay over the final minutes. His clenched fist and defiant grimace afterward served as yet another reminder to Portland of what had been missed in the 1984 draft. The Bulls fell into a deep hole in Game 6 back in Chicago, down 17 points late in the third quarter. Then Jackson pulled his regulars and played Bobby Hansen, B.J. Armstrong, Stacey King, and Scott Williams with Pippen. Hansen stole the ball and hit a shot, and the rally was on with Jordan on the bench leading the cheers. With about 8 minutes to go, Jackson sent him back in, and the Bulls powered their way to their second title, 97-93, bringing the stadium to an unprecedented eruption, the first pro championship won in Chicago by a Chicago team since the 1961 Bears won the NFL title at Soldier Field. "The final against Portland was a dramatic night for us and all Chicago fans," Jackson recalled. "We came from 17 down at the end of the third quarter to win the championship. What followed was an incredible celebration. The Bulls retreated to the locker room to engage in the usual ritual, spewing their champagne, wearing their new hats backward. Meanwhile, their fans remained upstairs in the stadium, thundering on in celebration. The team had gone down to the dressing room to be presented with the Larry O'Brien Trophy by David Stern and Bob Costas," remembered Bulls Vice President Steve Shanwald. "Jerry Reinsdorf and Jerry Krause and Phil Jackson and Michael and Scotty stood on a temporary stage and accepted the trophy. But we didn't have instant replay capability, so the fans were not able to share in that moment. Up in the stadium, we were playing Gary Glitter on the loudspeaker, and the crowd was just reveling in the championship. I went down and asked Jerry Reinsdorf if we could bring the team back up. He said, 'It's all right with me, but ask Phil.'" Jackson put 2 fingers in his mouth and whistled. Everything got quiet. "Grab that trophy," he said. "We're going back up to celebrate with our fans." Jordan grabbed the trophy, and the team followed him back upstairs. As they came through the tunnel, the game operations crew blasted "Eye in the Sky" by the Alan Parsons Project, the Bulls' intro music. "All of a sudden, the crowd just exploded," Shanwald recalled. "It was a 10,000 goosebump experience. All of a sudden, some of the players, Scotty and Horace and Hansen, those guys got up on the table so that everyone could see them in the crowd. Then Michael came up and joined them with a trophy, and they started dancing." Jordan held up 2 fingers for the crowd, then flashed 3, and the roar was deafening. Jackson enjoyed the scene for a time, then retreated back downstairs to reflect quietly alone. "Things had been up and down," he said later, "but we had had this one goal together, and despite our differences, we had focused on that one goal. I told the guys, a back-to-back championship is the mark of a great team. We had passed the demarcation point. Winning that second title set us apart." A few days later in Grant Park, Pippen again told hundreds of thousands of people that Chicago was going for a three-peat. The crowd cheered in response, but before Jordan could contemplate another title run, there was another little matter he had to deal with. Chapter 28. All That Glitters. The smart play might have been for Pippen and Jordan to decline their invitations to play for the United States in the 1992 Olympic Games in Barcelona. Krause hoped for as much. He wanted the Bulls superstars to rest over the summer. They both agreed to play, however, and Jordan soon found himself enmeshed in the Dream Team, the first U.S. Olympic team to include the best of American professional basketball. The group, in red, white, and blue, would be fated across the globe like mythical superheroes. Perhaps it was good for basketball, but it says much that their most competitive moment in terms of the game itself would come in an intra-squad scrimmage. They made chumps of everybody else and did a great job of showboating in the process, reducing the supposedly hallowed Olympic contests to pointless, mismatched affairs. Jordan knew all of this heading in and wasn't shy about saying it. When you look at the talent and the teams we're supposed to play against, it's a massacre, he had said months before the event. It should never be close. We taught them the game of basketball. We've got people who have the ability and the height. We're talking about the greatest players that play the game now, and the team is the best team that's ever been put together. Who's going to beat us? The Japanese? The Chinese? They can't match up to the athleticism we're going to have on this team. Not to mention the mental advantage we're going to have here with Magic or whoever's going to play the point. You have Stockton, Barkley, me, Robinson, Bird, come on. These are the people that the Europeans look up to, so how can they beat us? If a game is even close, it will be a moral victory for Europe. Blowouts had been a regular feature of previous Olympic basketball games, even when the United States relied solely on amateur players. Now, American professionals were lining up to be paid between $600,000 and $800,000 each for their much-hyped appearances. Surely, if the Olympians weren't already narcissists heading into the event, they would emerge with egos larger than many of the countries they faced. The U.S. Olympic Committee discreetly approached each player about donating his salary back to the cause. Jordan readily complied. Some others, who weren't raking in his Nike cash, hesitated, then gave all or part of it back. And the casinos in Monaco, where the team made a promotional visit on the eve of the Olympic Games, certainly took a share too. Jordan used the team's training camp in La Jolla, California to resume his golf challenge with Richard Esquinas. Playing between and around practices, he was able to reduce his gambling debt to $902,000. Esquinas would later tell the Los Angeles Times that Jordan's Olympic teammates were aware that he was wagering, but everybody knew not to come near the question of how much, Esquinas said. Jordan made most of his gains on the last day that they played, June 25th, at La Jolla Country Club. Esquinas joined Jordan one evening for a card game in Magic Johnson's Torrey Pines Hotel Suite, $100 a hand, with pots that got up to as much as $4,000. Clyde Drexler and Pippen were among the crew, as were several collegians from the scrimmage team, including Bobby Hurley, Chris Webber, and Eric Montrose. None of the collegians had the bank to join in the game, which made them the targets of Jordan's and Johnson's jibes. Esquinas recalled that every time Jordan put money in the kitty, Johnson would needle him about his tennis shoe cash. They may have become friends, but Johnson, it seemed, would never be able to get over Jordan's Nike deal, the gift that kept on giving. Soon enough, some girls showed up to distract the card players, and the evening would prove to be one in a run of party nights for the Dream Teamers. Esquinas's days with Jordan, however, had come to an end. They would continue to wrangle over the golfing losses, with various estimates suggesting that Jordan paid somewhere between $200,000 and $300,000, some of it in a series of $50,000 checks written by Juanita Jordan. Esquinas would bide his time, plotting a way to bring the matter to Jordan's attention one final time. The Olympics afforded the NBA's top stars their first real opportunity to spend time together and to get to know each other better. The group quickly learned of Jordan's indifference to rest. Throughout the experience, he would stay up long hours, smoking cigars, playing cards, hanging out, anything to avoid rest, leaving Charles Barkley and others shaking their heads in wonder. It was, said Chuck Daly, the team's coach, like Elvis and the Beatles put together. Traveling with the Dream Team was like traveling with 12 rock stars. That's all I can compare it to. The Americans played 14 games on their way to winning the gold, and their smallest margin of victory was 32 points. The subtext for the gathering was the continuing rivalry of Michael and Magic. Despite his HIV-positive status, Johnson had made the roster, yet another highlight in the emotional sequence of events that marked the protracted end to his playing career. He seemed intent on asserting his continued dominance as the game's best, never mind that his Lakers had lost convincingly in 1991. He and Jordan traded barbs over who was tops, then settled it during an intra-squad scrimmage when the team stopped over in Monaco before heading to Barcelona. It was closed to the press, but the competition featured one team led by Johnson and the other by Jordan, detailed in Jack McCallum's book Dream Team, celebrating the event and its successes 20 years later. Johnson's blue team, featuring Charles Barkley, Chris Mullin, David Robinson, and Christian Laettner, jumped out to a big lead, with Jordan and Johnson jawing away at each other. Jordan's team, with Scottie Pippen, Karl Malone, Patrick Ewing, and Larry Bird, managed to storm back to win over a furious Johnson, who grew angrier afterward as Jordan serenaded him with a song from his Gatorade ad. Sometimes I dream if I could be like Mike. It was the most fun I ever had on a basketball court, Jordan would say later. Magic Mike had conquered the hero of his youth for a final time. The affair had turned heated, but in the end, even Johnson, the natural-born leader of the assemblage, had to acknowledge that his time had passed, and Jordan had asserted once again that he was the king of the NBA Hill. Team USA claimed the gold with a 117-85 win over Croatia on August 8, 1992. They knew they were playing the best in the world, Daly said afterward, in part as justification for the mismatches. They'll go home and for the rest of their lives be able to tell their kids, I played against Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. And the more they play against our best players, the more confident they're going to get. The lone sticking point for Jordan had been Reebok's sponsorship of the team, which forced him to wear the logo of his business competitor, a matter he addressed by draping an American flag over the Reebok insignia during the ring ceremony. It was something neither demanded nor contrived by Nike, Sonny Vaccaro said, but Jordan's solution delighted company officials and demonstrated the depth of his legendary loyalty. One day not long afterward, Jordan and Pippen sat on the Bulls team bus talking about their Olympic teammates and the games. Just imagine, Pippen told Jordan, how good Clyde Drexler would be if he worked on fundamentals with Tex Winter. Like so many NBA players, Drexler was operating mostly off his great store of talent, absent any serious attention to the important details of the game. Jordan had been surprised to learn how lazy many of his Olympic teammates were about practice, how they were deceiving themselves about what the game required. One of their highlights had been their determination to shut down Croatian star Tony Kukoc, Krause's find, who was scheduled to join the Bulls for the 1993-94 NBA season. Kukoc was befuddled and embarrassed by the way they defended him during their competition. It was the same treatment that Jordan had leveled on every acquisition or rookie that Krause had brought to the team, but in the midst of Olympic play, some thought it seemed strangely out of place, none more so than Krause himself. At home, awaiting Jordan was his subpoena to testify in Slim Buller's criminal trial in North Carolina. He would be asked to explain why Buller, a convicted cocaine dealer, was in possession of a $57,000 check from his heiress. Jordan had first told authorities the money was a business loan, but under oath on the stand, he confessed it was for poker and gambling losses from one of the weekends at his Hilton Head home. He was not asked about the other three checks found in the briefcase of Eddie Dow, the bail bondsman who had been murdered during a robbery in February. Jordan had publicly acknowledged his lie in an interview with a Chicago newspaper several days before the trial began, saying he was embarrassed to say it at first, but the truth's got to come out. On the stand, he explained that he lost the money playing $1,000 Nassau with Buller and others at Hilton Head, although Jordan denied that he had been the victim of hustlers. It was just bad golf in a three-day period, he said. David Stern called Jordan to New York to discuss his activities and the company he had been keeping. Later, at a press conference, Jordan suggested that the men tied to him through the checks weren't actually friends, but mere acquaintances who had boasted of their activities with him. The paper trail was real, however, and growing. As the season was set to open, the NBA issued a reprimand of Jordan for gambling on golf and keeping unsavory company, which left him somewhat contrite during training camp. He told reporters he wouldn't quit gambling, but he would lower the stakes. Winning is great, but when you lose that amount and get all the abuse I got, it ain't worth it any longer, he said. I think people can accept my losing $40 or $50. It's easy to relate to. A $20 Nassau is something I should stick with. $20 Nassaus involved betting a limit of 20 on the front nine, 20 on the back nine, and 20 on the total score for 18 holes, making for a bet that would not exceed $60 total. The season ahead brought a welcome diversion from his time on the witness stand. He and the Bulls would try to win a third straight title, something that had not been done in almost 30 years, since Bill Russell and his merry Celtics had won eight straight championships in a period when the NBA had only 8 to 10 teams. The Jordan rules had captured him reflecting on his impending retirement and gave fans a glimpse of Jordan talking of stepping away from the pressure sometime in the next 5 years. He couldn't quite see the road ahead yet, and anyhow, he had a championship to win. But in that moment, no one had any idea how hard the coming year would be. The Phoenix. Phil Jackson's mind seemed to work in snapshots. One was a Jordan dunk over Miami's Ronnie Cicely in the first round of the 1992 playoffs, memorable as a throwback to Jordan's brush-high-against-the-rafters sort of stuff from his earlier days. That was just an awesome slam over Cicely that was one of those kind where he had to power over the top of everybody and look down at the basket, Jackson recalled, as the 1992-93 NBA season was set to open. It brought back memories for Jackson of a time before Jordan ruled the world. Things had changed that much for them all over a matter of just 12 months. They had gone from people who couldn't win it all to dominators. He used to do it for photo opportunities, the coach said of Jordan's dunking, as if he were talking about some entirely different creature. He did it for the entertainment value. He did it for the in-your-face effect. Now it's more or less a high-percentage shot. He has enough posters floating around. With the transformation Jordan had undergone, the dunk against Miami now seemed like one of his final unrestrained moments. It wasn't just that Jackson had changed Jordan's thinking about his approach to the game. It was also the effect of his off-court activities and the stress that Jordan had heaped on himself, atop all that others had piled upon him. It bothered me last year in the playoffs and at the end of last season, Jackson observed, still trying to process the team's run to two championships. I could see that he was running dry. It got a little bit old, and basketball usually doesn't get old for him many games out of the season. But it felt as if it did, particularly when there were so many things happening on the outside, and he became the focal point of everyone's perception of the athlete, what happens when things go wrong, the White House, the Jordan rules. A multitude of things that happened off the court affected him. The coach addressed the issues in a talk with his star, telling him that his love for the game, his ability to find intrigue and freshness in it, had to be renewed for the Bulls to survive the grind of trying to win a third straight championship. A host of mileposts lay in their immediate path, among them Jordan's 30th birthday just weeks down the road. He had to find a measure of joy in returning to the court, Jackson said. The Trib's Melissa Isaacson visited the issue with Jordan on the brink of the season. "It has to be fun," he told her. "I have to enjoy myself." That had become easier with the recent birth of his third child, Jasmine, a bright-eyed baby girl. His sons were a pair of grinning bear cubs, into everything and reminding Jordan of the good old days with his brother Larry. His main hope was that all of the off-court headaches were behind him now, that all he would have to consider this season would be his family and the game. That proved to be wishful thinking. Sam Smith's revelatory book had set the agenda for the end of his career, an agenda that was now being hastened by the off-court issues. Jackson took some comfort in the fact that Jordan still had 3 years left on his contract, which might allow him to see beyond the current headaches. Asked by Isaacson how he would know he had reached the end of his playing days, Jordan replied, "When guys I used to go past start going past me, I want to always stay ahead of my competition, to always have the upper hand." His game would have to continue to evolve, but one thing remained steady. He wanted to hear no talk of reduced playing time. The entertainer in him remained very much alive. "I still have the desire to create," he said that November. "That's part of me, always will be." Yet he was well aware that the way teams had begun to defend him would limit the acrobatics of his previous seasons. Since the Bulls had moved to the triangle, he had spent considerable time developing his post-up moves because the offense continued to offer him interesting ways to work closer to the basket, behind the defense, where it became harder to double-team him. The process of watching him adapt the offense to his own game fascinated Tex Winter. Jordan obviously understood how it reconfigured the floor. He could read where the opportunity lay like no other player who had come before him, which even allowed Winter to see his beloved triangle in new and different ways. Jordan also understood instinctively that the changes would require a re-education for his fans and the basketball public. He had seen the public's misreading of the end of Julius Erving's career and wanted to avoid that for himself. "When Dr. J retired, everyone said, 'Yeah, he should get out of the game, he's old,'" Jordan explained. "But Dr. J was still a good player. It was just that people, from years of playing against him, knew some of his tendencies and tried to push him into situations where he couldn't be as creative as he used to be. He was taking what the defense was giving him." Encouraged by his coach, Jordan was already preparing a similar adjustment, which would be aided by an offensive system that rephrased the new tactics presented by the defense as gifts. Jackson believed it was no longer a matter of how high he jumped. The opponent's new defensive tactics actually worked in Jordan's favor by forcing him to a more sustainable approach. "My game is less spectacular because I'm taking more outside shots," he acknowledged. "People saw my creativity a little better because I was going to the hole more and creating more and dunking on people more and more. It's tough to get in there now because everyone's clogging the paint. Most of my inside play now is strictly from post-ups. When I'm on the perimeter, either the double team is started or they back up and give me the jump shot. Jumpers were always a function of the confidence of the moment, not just for Jordan, but for anyone playing the game. The triangle provided him an important option if he got backed into that corner. Instead of shooting jumpers or trying to knife through the defense to attack the basket, he could now slip into the low post and feel confident that the offense would deliver him the ball at just the right moment. "It's just an adjustment to the way people play me," he explained, "and it's not really because of my physical deficiency or deterioration. It's more the way teams are playing me." Watching Jordan find those post-up moments in the previous playoffs had made Jackson confident that his star would continue in adjusting his game, sustaining his success. Jordan cautioned that he wasn't going to engage in wild experimentation, just subtle adjustment. And he did offer this promise to his many fans: there would still be dunks. "My game is such that creativity is always going to be a part of it," he told Isaacson. "But it just happens. It's not something I plan. It was something I was taught very early in my career, to go out and try to please the crowd. You never really play the game you want to play." Despite all that, the 1992-93 season still opened with a quick, unforeseen flare-up when Horace Grant took umbrage at Jackson's allowing Jordan and Pippen to sit out portions of training camp. The coach was concerned that they recover from their busy summers. Grant complained to reporters about double standards and preferential treatment. Later in the season, he would accuse Pippen of arrogance. Ultimately, this sniping would cause a rift between the two friends, but both agreed that they weren't as close as they had been. It was the sort of divisiveness that Jackson loathed. To go with it, the Bulls encountered a rash of physical ailments. Cartwright, 35, and Paxson, 32, had off-season surgery on their creaky knees, and Pippen would be troubled by a bad ankle for most of the year. For Jordan, the pains were first his arch, then his wrist, and always the ever-present tendonitis in his knees. B.J. Armstrong, who had struggled with the Bulls' triple-post offense, finally was comfortable enough to replace Paxson in the starting lineup. The coaches had decided that the 21-year-old Armstrong was simply better equipped to play in the Bulls' pressure defense, and that would make the difference in the playoffs. Plus, he would lead the league in three-point shooting, hitting better than 45%. For the regular season, however, Jackson planned to back off from the pressure defense, hoping to conserve his players' energy and health. The move irritated Jordan, who felt that without their defense, games became harder to win. The change also revealed another issue for the veteran club: boredom. The slowed pace worked against them until at one point during the season, Jordan called an on-court huddle and told his teammates to resume the pressure. Later, he debated Jackson's strategy with reporters. "Maybe we gamble and we lose our legs," he said. "I still don't think we get conservative now. When we slow down, things get too deliberate." If nothing else, the issue demonstrated the mental interplay between the coach and star player. Sometimes it resembled a board game in which Jordan was perfectly capable of holding his own. In the end, these issues were merely added entertainment value. Their only real opponent was what Jordan called monotony, that loss of joy that had concerned Jackson at the start of the season. December would bring the coach's 200th win. He had reached the mark faster than any coach in league history. Concerned as he was about his off-kilter team, he took little sense of achievement from the milestone. "Guys were hurt," Jackson explained. "Pippen with his ankle, Jordan with his plantar fascia. All of those things prevented us from getting a rhythm. We weren't in great condition, so when practices were done hard and precise, we ended up suffering in our game effort." Rather than miss games, Jordan had to sit out his favorite time with the team. "I have always liked practice," he said, "and I hate to miss it. It's like taking a math class. When you miss that one day, you feel like you missed a lot. You take extra work to make up for that one day. I've always been a practice player. I believe in it." His loss of being able to experience joy in practice was the first major sign, he would say later. Practice was where he had played some of his best basketball. The things he did there were the prelude to his performances in games. He had always approached it with tremendous anticipation and enthusiasm. It had never been something to just get through or to sit out. "I knew it was time for me to get out," he would say later, looking back. "They were tired," recalled Bulls trainer Chip Schaefer. "No question. Michael and Scotty were tired in the fall of 92. That was just a tough, long year, and a really tough year for Michael. It seemed like one thing after another. The press was picking on him, things just happening all year long. As soon as one thing would let up, it seemed like another came into play. There was one book or one incident constantly. It got to be not about basketball, but personal things that really shouldn't have been part of it at all. You could just see it starting to wear on him a little bit. In some private moments, He expressed that. It was really evident that he was getting tired, tired physically, tired mentally, of the whole thing. The situation left Jackson digging in his bag of mental tricks to keep things fresh and to keep his team motivated. Phil played a lot of mind games, Jordan recalled. He waged psychological warfare to make you realize the things you have to do to be a winner. Some rewards along the way helped out. On January 8th, Jordan scored his 20,000th career point, a total he had reached in just 620 games. The only man to do it faster was Chamberlain, who reached the milestone in 499 games. It looks like I fell short of Wilt again, which is a privilege, Jordan said. I won't evaluate this until I'm away from the game. I'm happy about it, but we still have a long season to go. I'm sure as I get older, I'll cherish it more. No matter how hard Jackson worked, the team always returned to the same issues. In a telling span of games that same month with Orlando, Magic coach Matt Gukas instructed his roster, which included rookie center Shaquille O'Neal, to keep their attention on Jordan. Every time he had the ball at the free throw line extended and below, we would double team him with the next closest guy, Gukas recalled. Then we made sure we would rotate to John Paxson because we were concerned about his shooting. We were leaving a lot of things open, and Michael just carved us up. He found open teammates, and everyone reveled in the victory. Left unguarded for stretches, Pippen and Grant had big nights, and the Bulls won easily. 2 games later, the teams met again in Chicago Stadium, and this time Gukas elected to let Jordan roam while he worked to keep his teammates covered. Orlando was missing starters Nick Anderson and Dennis Scott that night. I said, "There's no way we double-team him," Gukas recalled. He tabbed role player Anthony Bowie to take Jordan on defense. I said, "I don't care what he gets, but no dunks, no layups. Make sure you're back on defense. Give him all the jumpers he wants," which was the way everybody played Michael earlier in his career. So we go out and we're dropping off of him, playing about 8 to 10 feet off, taking away his drive. But it's one of those nights where he's hitting his jumper. Jordan took shot after open shot, a career-high 49 attempts, 7 more than all of his teammates combined, and they began to look disgusted while the Magic kept it close. "We're still in the game," Gukas recalled, "and their guys are not." The contest went to overtime, and Jordan finished with 64, his second highest game. The Magic, though, came away with the win, confirming for Gukas that the best strategy was still to try to make Jordan a one-man team. In March, Washington Bullets rookie LaBradford Smith scored 37 against him in Chicago, and afterward Jordan claimed Smith had told him, "Nice game, Mike." Jordan was supposedly furious at the comment. In the postgame show, he talked of being embarrassed and how it wouldn't happen the next night when the two teams were scheduled to meet again in Washington. He later said he would get all 37 points back by halftime and spent much of the time talking about his retribution and psyching himself up. Although he seldom came onto the floor early for pregame shooting, he was out there the next night, working himself into a groove. He started the game 8 of 8 and would go on to post 36 by the half. He finished with 47, but it would be years before he admitted that he made the whole thing up. Smith had never said anything to him. He had falsified the entire affair as a means of driving himself to play at a higher level. The question was, how much longer could he play mind games with himself? For each of the previous 4 seasons, his team had played more than 100 games, and his knees had begun to feel every one of them. A week later in Houston, he sat tiredly in the locker room before the game and recognized that he was losing his legendary focus. His teammates, consumed with their own issues, were much the same, and Jordan realized this was exactly why teams failed to repeat as champions. Jackson had sensed earlier in the season that his team was headed to the point where the players thought more about the future than they did the game in front of them. "My biggest lesson about being successful is that you don't change," Jordan would explain later. "The people around you change. When we became successful as an organization, a lot of people around this organization started to change. A lot of people can't deal with being successful. First," he said, "they become focused on their own interests, on what they don't have. That's not a fun mentality to have," he added. He then began telling his teammates he was done. They'd have a couple of beers after a game, and he would talk about it. No one believed him. But he began telling others too, like his father, the people in his entourage, Dean Smith, and other confidants. His teammates considered it merely bellyaching. Jordan decided that if he was nearing the finish, he wanted to close it out in the right fashion. Would he and his teammates be able to outrun these bad thoughts long enough to win another title? Dean Smith had always wanted to come see Jordan play in Chicago, and he showed up at one of the final regular season games that spring. They visited before the game, and Jordan told his old mentor that he was thinking about moving on from the game. Jordan went out and played self-consciously that night, mindful that Smith would reserve his greatest scrutiny for his defensive play. In Carolina practices, the coach awarded points for defense, not offense. Any time that he knew Smith was watching him on TV, Jordan tried to make sure he focused on defense. He would laugh to himself, thinking that he was almost a decade out of school, and still Smith had that power over him. On this night, late in the season, he played poorly on offense and put all of his energy into defense. With two final losses to Charlotte and New York, the Bulls finished with 57 wins, their fourth straight 50-win season, good for another divisional championship. But they had lost home court advantage for the playoffs to the Knicks. Individually, Jordan would claim a seventh straight scoring crown, 30.3 points per game, tying him with Wilt Chamberlain. He would be named All-NBA First Team again, and both he and Pippen would make the All-Defense First Team. It's a funny thing to look at the history of the NBA and the way teams kind of rise and fall, trainer Chip Schaefer noted. For all intents and purposes, it looked like it was going to be New York's year. They paid their dues. The Knicks absolutely destroyed us, beat us up by 37 points in late November that year. They played like it was Game 7 in the playoffs. We went in kind of yawning, no big deal. Michael sprained his foot early in the game, and they just crushed us. We still won 57 games that year, but we just kind of foundered. For 2 years, the Knicks had seen their championship hopes end in 7-game playoff battles with the Bulls. They figured they needed the home court advantage to advance out of Jordan's shadow. New York coach Pat Riley drove his team to 60 wins and gained that edge. The Bulls, meanwhile, seemed almost distracted heading into the playoffs. But they quickly picked up the pace, sweeping 3 from Atlanta in the first round, then devastating the Cleveland Cavaliers again by winning 4 straight. Jordan capped the series with a last-second game-winner in Cleveland that closed the chapter on his domination of the Cavaliers. Once the playoffs rolled around, Schaefer recalled, Michael managed to turn it on again. But we faced New York again. We didn't have home court, so there really wasn't much reason to be optimistic about it. Jordan hated the Knicks. They played like the Pistons, he said testily. Moreover, Jackson and Riley still disliked each other from their playing days. In Game 1 in Madison Square Garden, the Knicks knocked Jordan into a 10-for-27 shooting night and won 98-90. I told the team I let them down, Jordan said, but the same thing happened in Game 2. He missed 20 of 32 shots, and New York seized a 2-game lead, 96-91. Afterward, the smugness in the city was tangible, and for good reason. Now the Bulls are down 2 games and have to beat the Knicks 4 games out of 5 games if they are going to have a chance at 3 titles in a row, wrote New York Daily News columnist Mike Lupica. The outcome was further weighted in the aftermath with a New York Times report that Jordan had been seen at an Atlantic City casino in the wee hours before Game 2, suggesting that perhaps he wasn't properly rested for competition. Jackson and Krause quickly came to his defense. There is no problem with Michael Jordan, Krause told reporters. He cares about winning and is one of the great winners of all time. We don't need a curfew, Jackson added. These are adults. You have to have other things in your life or the pressure becomes too great. Jordan himself was unrepentant, but his father stepped up and explained to reporters that he had encouraged his son to go to Atlantic City. Privately, however, many around the team were staggered by the father's poor judgment. Jordan already faced scrutiny and an NBA investigation over the Slim Buller case, and James Jordan thought it might be a good idea for his son to go gamble in Atlantic City in the midst of a playoff series. With this issue hovering over the team, the series moved to Chicago. The Bulls came back for practice at the Berto Center, recalled veteran Chicago radio reporter Cheryl Ray Stout. I've never seen as much media gathered for an event. Michael stepped out of the training room, and I said, Michael, would you just go over the chain of events for us? Would you tell us what happened and where this story is coming from? He did, and then a television news person from a local Chicago station started grilling him as though he were an alderman being convicted of a crime. Chuck Gowdy from Channel 7 was saying things like, do you do this before every game? Do you have a gambling problem? He kept hammering and hammering away, and eventually Michael just shut up and walked away. Jordan ceased speaking with the media, and his teammates followed suit, which would lead to fines from the NBA for violating media policy. James Jordan had hovered around for years, smiling pleasantly, joking with those in and around the team, continually encouraging his son. Now, with the tension high and his son seething, he picked a rainy Sunday to talk to the media outside the team's practice facility. I don't mind speaking for Michael, he said. He's my child. You do whatever you can for your child. He had told Michael privately that he believed he had no more challenges on the court, that it was the off-court issues that were driving him away from the game. And now James began his talk with the reporters, first by almost pleading, but then his voice lost any softness. He knows he's in the fishbowl, under the microscope, his father said, adding that there should be some time in Jordan's life where that was not the case. You just have to say, hey, this guy's human. I mean, what is enough? That's the big question right now. What is enough? Pretty soon, when you keep tipping the bucket up, there's not going to be anything in there after a while. You're going to pour it all out. And that's what we should start realizing as fans. Trying to offer insight about his son, James Jordan told reporters, my son doesn't have a gambling problem, he has a competition problem. The immediate competition problem was the Knicks. Jordan was sure his Bulls would win. The hole was deep, it seemed, but they had found the bottom. With Pippen taking charge, Chicago won big in Game 3 in the stadium, 103-83. The moment I knew we were going to win that series was after Game 3, Chip Schaefer recalled. After we'd beat them pretty soundly and brought the series back to 2-1, Patrick Ewing made a comment that, we don't have to win here in Chicago. As soon as I heard him say that, I knew we were going to win the series. If you have that attitude, you may lose a game and lose your edge. You can't assume you're going to win all of your home games. As soon as he said that, it told me he was counting on winning all their home games, which wasn't going to happen. It was Scotty who got us that series. He always seemed to have a knack when Michael might have been having a tough time to step up and do what needed to be done. Jordan did his part too, by turning his anger into a searing focus, first with 54 points to drive Chicago to a win in Game 4, 105-95. Then it was Jordan's triple-double, 29 points, 10 rebounds, and 14 assists, that dominated the statistics column in Game 5, when Chicago took the series lead 3-2. But it was Pippen's successive blocks of putback attempts by New York's Charles Smith late in Game 5 in New York that closed off the Knicks' hopes. Then, when the Bulls completed their comeback in Game 6 in Chicago, it was Pippen again doing the final damage, a corner jumper and a tray in a 96-88 victory. The road had been rocky, but the Bulls were returning to their third straight NBA Finals, where Jordan would face his old caddy, Charles Barkley, both of them at the top of the game for that instant. After several frustrating years in Philadelphia, Barkley had been traded to Phoenix before the 1992-93 season, and like that, he had been reborn, earning league MVP honors and leading the Suns to 62 wins and a trip to the finals after a serious playoffs bout with the Houston Rockets. It was a great finals when you look back on it, from an entertainment standpoint, competitive standpoint, recalled Matt Gukas, who had coached Barkley in Philadelphia. I think Charles, in his mind, felt recognized as a guy who was on the same plane with Michael Jordan. With the championship meeting, the personal competition between the two friends would now fall under the view of the larger audience. Any time we'd get in a close game with the Bulls, Charles would want to guard Michael the last 2 or 3 minutes down the stretch, Gukas recalled. He had the guts, he had the stones, and Charles was not afraid to fail either. He knew that there was a possibility that Michael could make him look bad, but he was almost the equal of an athlete than Michael was. Barkley was always annoyed by Jordan's seemingly constant residence in a hotel room somewhere. Sir Charles loved to get out and carouse to interact with the public, which was where he'd always found trouble in his Philadelphia days. But in Phoenix, the array of golf courses in the Valley of the Sun had meant that he had no trouble attracting Jordan for some fun. The title bout between them was certainly hard-fought, but it left a bitter aftertaste, with suggestions from the Bulls camp that Jordan had intentionally played Barkley for several years, softening him up with lavish gifts, so that he could dominate him on the court. Barkley himself would later be left to wonder, despite 3 years of friendship. Jordan had been displeased with Barkley's practice habits with the dream team in Barcelona, and would later admit that he drew a competitive edge from that. Pippen, meanwhile, was not a Sir Charles fan, and would later publicly berate him for kissing Michael's ass, an accusation that left Barkley bristling. Yet it would remain largely an unanswered question. Had Jordan hoodwinked Barkley just when he was close to the main prize? Afterward, Jordan offered that the main difference between them was experience. He knew what to expect from the series in terms of pressure, but Barkley really didn't. You had to be ready for that kind of burden, Jordan said. For the TV audience, Barkley and Jordan were squared off in a pop culture war, Nike commercial versus Nike commercial. In his ads, Jordan pondered, what if I were just a basketball player? While Barkley, in his spot, declared, I am not a role model, playing on his controversial public image. Some critics saw him as another highly paid but irresponsible performer. Others understood that Barkley's statement was a reminder that pro athletes were merely media images and that the real responsibility for instilling values in young people belonged in the home. Barkley explained as much, but that did little to deter his critics, who focused on the tabloid gossip, highlighted by supposed sightings of him with Madonna at a Phoenix restaurant. There was Jordan's gambling, and Sir Charles was always Sir Charles. The irony in 1993 was that Barkley had shown no forethought, no hesitation in trashing his own public image during his early NBA seasons, while the more circumspect Jordan had proceeded cautiously, always saying and doing the correct corporate things while persistently building Chicago into a winner. At times, when Barkley's occasional bar fights or misguided public statements made headlines, Jordan had publicly come to his defense, the primary message being that Charles may tend to run his mouth before thinking, but he is an honest, genuine person and a tough competitor. Now, however, Jordan had arrived in Phoenix with his own pack of tabloid hounds sniffing out the trail of scandal. Fortunately, the basketball was good enough to eclipse the other storylines. When the series opened in the brand new America West Arena, the Bulls had plenty of confidence. They had always done well against Barkley's Philadelphia teams. Pippen's and Grant's defense would shackle the burly forward again, and B.J. Armstrong had the quickness to stay with Phoenix point guard Kevin Johnson. As if willed by a media strategist's perfect timing, Jordan's shadow life again surfaced on the eve of the championship series. No sooner had the Atlantic City casino jaunt fallen out of the news than Richard Esquina stepped forward with a self-published book, Michael and Me, Our Gambling Addiction, My Cry for Help. In the book, Esquinas went into great detail about his high-stakes golf wagering with Jordan. In a taped interview on NBC at halftime of Game 1 of the Finals, Jordan admitted that he had lost substantial sums to Esquinas, but nowhere near the figure claimed. Esquinas, meanwhile, presented copies of his tax returns and copies of Jordan's checks. He had apparently paid off approximately $300,000 of the debt before turning to a Chicago lawyer to keep Esquinas at bay. Gamblers don't belong in sports, wrote columnist Dave Kindred in Sporting News. They are vulnerable to extortion. They are vulnerable to temptations to bet on what they know best, their game. These vulnerabilities undermine the public's confidence that the games are honest. But Jordan doesn't seem to care. It's as if he lives his life by the gospel decreed in his shoe shills pitch, just do it. At no time was Jordan alleged to have bet on any NBA games, his defenders pointed out. If that was the case, it was the only thing Jordan didn't bet on, Newsweek suggested. At practice, he'll wager on trick shots or play horse for cash. On the Chicago Bulls plane, he runs games of 21 or Tonk, a sort of gin rummy. On the road, he hosts all-night poker games in his hotel room. 3 years ago, the team began using its own charter plane to protect the players' privacy, but also, it seems now, to keep away the embarrassing view of the hundreds of dollars spread across airport lounge tables, the stakes in Jordan's card games. Questions about whether these distractions would hinder the Bulls were quickly put aside when Chicago claimed the first game, 192. Jordan scored 31 and Pippen 27, while the Bulls' defense harassed Barkley into shooting just 9 for 25. Perhaps the Suns had merely blinked in their first time in the championship spotlight, but they sank deeper into trouble in Game 2. Barkley and Jordan each scored 42 points, but Jordan's accompanied a near triple-double with his 12 rebounds and 9 assists, plus 2 steals, all in 40 minutes of playing time. He also made 18 of his 36 shots from the field and both of his three-point attempts, helping the Bulls to a 111-108 win. The Chicago defense also clamped down on Kevin Johnson and wing Dan Marley to take the 2-0 series lead. Part of the win can be attributed to a defensive scheme drawn up by Johnny Bock for Armstrong to counter Kevin Johnson, who grew frustrated and sat out much of the fourth quarter. Suddenly, Phoenix faced 3 games in Chicago and the prospects of a sweep. But somehow the Suns managed to scratch out a 129-121 triple overtime win in Game 3. I thought it was never going to end, Jackson said afterward. Jordan responded with 55 points for a 108-98 win in Game 4 to give the Bulls a 3-1 series lead. Phoenix allowed him time and again to glide inside for handsome little dunks and bank shots. In 46 minutes of playing time, he had made 21 of 37 from the floor to go with 13 made free throws, 8 rebounds, and 4 assists. Phoenix pulled to within 2 at the end, but Armstrong's pressure and a key late steal closed it out. Jordan's point total tied Golden State's Rick Barry for second place on the all-time NBA Finals single-game list. The record was held by Elgin Baylor, who scored 61 in a game against Boston in 1962. Up 3-1 with Game 5 on their home floor, the Bulls stood on the verge of their third straight. However, they strangely teetered there. Jordan swore to his teammates that he wouldn't accompany them back to Phoenix if they failed to deliver the championship in the stadium. To back that up, he scored 41 points in 44 minutes on 16 of 29 shooting from the field, with 7 rebounds, 7 assists, and 2 blocks. Regardless, Chicago stumbled, and the Suns busied themselves with defense. Jordan's easy baskets disappeared as Phoenix congregated in the lane. With Johnson scoring 25 and Barkley 24, the Suns got the win they needed, 108-98, to return the series to Arizona. Chicago's previous championships had been marked by riotous celebration that rocked the city, so before Game 5, many merchants had boarded up their stores. "We did the city a favor," Barkley said as he left town. "You can take all those boards down now. We're going to Phoenix." Jordan was furious over the loss and angry with his teammates, who were grappling with their own disappointment. Behind the scenes, his wife and older sister pleaded with him to arrange for his jet to take the family to Game 6. He finally relented, perhaps figuring that the cost of the trip would stoke his focus on the task at hand. The Jordan family remained riddled with division, with James and Dolores still fighting over proceeds and royalties from the sale of the Flight 23 stores. Sis described the circumstances as miserable as her parents sought to pull their children into the conflict, especially Michael. Sis sat back and looked at her brother in that moment with no longer enough hours in his days or enough hands to handle the many tasks that had been set before him. She recalled, "I watched from afar as Michael juggled life on and off the court, riding the waves of mega success and bringing his teammates as well as his family along for the ride." "Michael seems to sense what a team needs," recalled Bulls broadcaster Tom Doerr. They had just lost, but Michael walked on the plane going to Phoenix and said, "Hello, world champs." He's got a foot-long cigar and he's celebrating already because he knows the series is over. He knew, going to Phoenix, that they were going to win. It wasn't a question with him, and I think that's what the team had. They just had this arrogance. They weren't mean about it. They just felt like they were going to win. That moxie seemed to drive Chicago through the first three quarters of Game 6 as the Bulls' phalanx of guards, Jordan, Armstrong, Paxson, and seldom-used reserve Trent Tucker, fired in 9 three-pointers over the first three periods to stake Chicago to an 87-79 lead. There once again on the brink of the title, the Bulls turned cold. They missed 9 shots and had 2 turnovers their first 11 possessions of the fourth quarter. The Suns closed within a point, then surged to take a 98-94 lead with 90 seconds left. After a miss, Jordan pulled down a defensive rebound and wound his way through traffic to the other end for a short bank shot. It was 98-96 with 38 seconds to go. The shooting by Suns wing Dan Marley had helped Phoenix back into the series, but on their next-to-last possession, he delivered an air ball, which brought the Bulls one more chance with 14.1 seconds to go. After a timeout, Jordan inbounded the ball to Armstrong, then got it back and passed ahead to Pippen. The play was drawn up to go back to Chicago's sure thing, but Pippen saw that Jordan was covered, so he motored into the lane where he was greeted by Suns center Mark West. Alone on the near baseline was Grant, who had scored a single point in the game and who had a stick-back opportunity moments earlier and had almost thrown the ball over the backboard. Pippen whipped him the ball. With the game on the line, Grant passed up the shot to send the ball out to Paxson, all alone in three-point land to the left of the key. "I knew it was in as soon as Pax shot it," Jordan said. The three-pointer, along with Grant's block of Kevin Johnson's last shot, ended the suspense and brought the Bulls their third championship. During the finals, Jordan had averaged 41 points per game, breaking the championship series record of 40.8 points per game set by Rick Barry in 1967. The party was restrained back in his suite after the game. Jordan was shirtless, in gym shorts. George Kohler was there, opening bottles of very expensive champagne. Quinn Buckner, too. But the quiet celebration was more about family. Sis and her mother sat with Michael on one couch. James sat facing them on another with Roz. They relaxed and smiled, and Michael even pounced on his younger sister for a brief wrestling bout. It would be the last time they were all together. As his personal misery had mounted, there was little question among Jordan's close associates that he had grown weary of the grind and the lack of privacy. In his public comments, he had made oblique references to retirement. He might have done it earlier if he hadn't feared losing his product endorsement fees and Nike sales, writer Sam Smith had noted in The Jordan Rules. His off-court troubles had only increased the public perception that he might leave the game after his third title. Reporters converged upon him afterward in the media sessions to ask if indeed he planned to retire. "No," he assured them, "my love for this game is strong." Part 9. Far and Away. Chapter 29. The Lexus. He had made winning seem too easy. Only Phil Jackson and the Bulls' tight inner circle understood what a grind the three straight championships had been. that Jordan had been able to succeed with huge doses